I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th, what's the date? Today is the 13th of January. And tomorrow night on PBS's American Experience 1964, LBJ and the Great Society, Barry Goldwater and the birth of modern conservatism, Cassius Clay becoming Muhammad Ali, Freedom Summer and the deaths of Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Michael Schwerner, which brought national exposure to what was going on in Mississippi. The rise of Malcolm X, the Beatles, Betty Friedan, the free speech movement on the campus of UC Berkeley.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving.
The director and writer of the documentary 1964 is our guest this hour, Stephen Ives. He's been doing work in public television for 20 years. He created The West, Lindbergh, had a decades-long collaboration with Ken Burns as co-producer of A History of the United States Congress, and as a consulting producer on the series The Civil War and Baseball. Since 2003, he's directed 8 films for American Experience: Seabiscuit, Las Vegas, New Orleans, Kit Carson, Roads to Memphis, Panama Canal, Custer's Last Stand, and Grand Coulee Dam. 1964, critical in shaping the country that we live in today. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to, this is a place we can do this, hear your memories of 1964 if you were alive then. Stephen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. You know, I was thinking of the music, and it's always fun to look at a year with music. You say in the documentary it started with Bobby Vinton, There I've Said It Again, and a very youthful Bob Dylan in the times they are a-changin', also a part of the music of 1964. Shows you there were some things going on, huh?
There sure were, and of course we all remember Bobby Vinton, but you can tell the magnitude of the shift culturally in America just by those two songs. And what's really going on is a break in the consensus that had been ruling America since the New Deal and World War II, a kind of sort of understanding of that black and white world that we lived in that was deeply constrained, and what you see in 64 really is the beginning of all of these cracks in the foundation of that consensus.
Right.
The way in which all of these issues that have been part of the fabric of American life begin to fray and fall apart, and so it's a time of really remarkable change.
And many of us had already fallen apart when the year started because, as you remind us early in the film, it was only 5 weeks earlier from the beginning of that year that our president had been assassinated.
Yeah, it's a little ironic to make a film called 1964 and begin it in 1963, but historians, we can take a little bit of license when we need it, and that's the moment where, you know, you can't not date everything back to that traumatic and deeply shattering experience for Americans. And even showing the film to people today, I'm still struck by the magnitude of the emotion that people feel about having lived through or remembering that moment. And I think, of course, what Kennedy's assassination does, besides sort of usher in a fundamental and sudden change of style and leadership, it practically puts Lyndon Johnson in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the things that he goes on to do in terms of his political agenda were Kennedy ideas, but Kennedy was helpless to try and move them through a divided Congress. And so it's so interesting that that tragedy thrusts this man into the Oval Office, and he's the one that manages to engineer historic change in the way we think about race and civil rights, and in many ways the whole idea of an equal society.
Right.
So it does. It's fate is truly a part of this story.
And there are so many dramatic elements in this year of 64. I was so struck by the footage you have of television ads trying to sell women every gadget that was available to make their housewife lives as happy and fulfilling as possible, which, of course, they weren't. And to couple that with Betty Friedan, to look at what was going on in Mississippi and then subsequently in other cities when it came to race issues. There was so much that was just waiting to explode that was right below the surface, right?
Yeah, and what's interesting is you don't really, the feminine mystique is an interesting example. I mean, here's a book published by a student of psychology and writer named Betty Friedan, and she basically says that she puts her finger on the fact that millions of American women are unhappy and they don't know why. They've got a husband. They've got appliances. They've got a nice house in the suburbs. They've got three kids. They've got everything that American culture has told them they need to be blissfully and completely happy. And in fact, instead, they're miserable. And it's because they're being denied what we all realize in our liberated world today to be a fundamental need in human nature, which is to be develop as a human being and to have some agency and some part of directing their own lives. And so it's this great shock to women at that time that they finally understand this feminine mystique, this myth that's been created by advertisers that says that they should be this kind of perfect woman, happy with their lot in life. And in fact, they need to demand much more. And it's just an example of how in this year these earthquakes begin to happen, and they trigger a kind of a tsunami of change that's going to ripple throughout the decade, in this case having to do with the feminist movement.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the more dramatic footage in the whole documentary, which is really well done, is what happened during Freedom Summer. I hadn't seen some of that before. When you talk about women wanting to be able to develop as human beings, and then you've got a movement in Mississippi and elsewhere where African Americans just wanted to be recognized as human beings.
Well, of course, you know, you have tremendous amounts of tension and struggle in 63 with the March on Washington, which really puts civil rights center stage. But again, in 64, it does feel like things come to an absolute boiling point. At one point, this marvelous and very admirable civil rights activist named Dave Dennis says, We were tired, and we knew that we had to try something, and the time was right. They had been under almost, you know, combat conditions, some of these civil rights workers in the South, for years. And then Medgar Evers was killed, church bombings that killed a group of kids, and so they really were at a place where they had to try and roll the dice and try something new, and that strategy, which was so risky for them, was to take advantage of a remarkable collection of idealistic young people, mostly college kids, who wanted to come down to Mississippi for a summer and work on voter registration. And they were predominantly white and from pretty upper class backgrounds, pretty well connected college kids. And so it was a tremendous culture clash, not only for the activists and these new recruits, but also for the folks in Mississippi when all these kids showed up. And of course, the results were both violent and tragic.
Mm-hmm. And then you had what really drew national attention, do you think? Is that what drew national attention, were the deaths of Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Michael Schwerner?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the whole idea of Freedom Summer was a kind of a novel thing. And you can tell by the amount of press coverage just before they even go down, covering their training in a small college in Oxford, Ohio. But, I mean, I do think that although, as this wonderful historian Dan Carter says in the film, they weren't intended to be sacrificial lambs, but that's exactly what they ended up being.
Mm-hmm.
When black civil rights workers were killed, there might be a tiny mention on page 19A of the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
but when two white kids from New York died with a local black teenager, young man from Mississippi, it was front page news, and it dominated the news for weeks, to a degree that we don't really realize now in our internet and cable world, when all three networks, and there were only three, turned their lens on this story, it became an overwhelmingly big story, something that Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover couldn't ignore.
Mm-hmm. You interview Michael Schwerner's wife at that time, which I found very interesting. What did she say? What were her reminiscences? And did she not meet with LBJ over this issue?
She did. Her name now is Rita Bender, and she is an immensely admirable person who didn't want to now and then talk about this as a purely personal matter. She always saw the death of her husband as being a larger point about the struggle of all civil rights workers at that time to be given protection. They were regularly under constant threat, bomb threats and death threats and other forms of intimidation. It was really like being behind enemy lines on some level. And they weren't being given federal protection because constitutionally it's not something that the president really has a lot of control over. And after her husband disappeared, Rita went to Washington and got into a face-to-face meeting with Johnson and was quite blunt about what she felt needed to be done and the fact that she felt the president wasn't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful moment because she really is speaking truth to power. Even though deep down Johnson's trying to do the right thing, he's also a politician who's basically trying to make a bad PR problem go away. And
right.
She calls him on it, and it's a, sort of a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it is, that whole story. And who gave the eulogy, the Cheney eulogy? That was a dramatic piece of footage as well.
Well, that's this guy, Dave Dennis.
He's somewhat
of an unsung hero of the civil rights movement in many ways. His friend Bob Moses, who was a major organizer, is often sort of gets a little bit more coverage and credit for it. But Dave was really a central organizer and architect of Freedom Summer. And he was the one that had sent these young men into harm's way. He was actually supposed to be with them that night. They were driving his car. The only reason he stayed behind was because he had bronchitis or something and needed to recover for a day. So he came within, you know, a single decision of being murdered as well. And he ended up having to give a eulogy for these men that is one of the most powerful pieces of testimony, I think, from the entire civil rights movement. It's
yes.
just a stunning piece of honest testimony and one that I think is worth remembering.
Yes, it is. And he, all these years later, was still very, very emotional about it.
I know. He's such an extraordinarily dignified and smart guy. And the fact that he still feels this as deeply as he does, I think, is a testament to how much and how committed he was then and how much he remains today in terms of fighting for equality. He had been in the Harlem riots, which is another part of our story. This is the first time that a northern city erupted in violence. It's the moment that sort of is the trigger for all of the riots that are going to come in 65 and 66 thereafter. And he saw a very horrific scene of violence in the streets of Harlem that is with him still. And it all came back to him when he was trying to give this eulogy down in Mississippi.
Mm. We welcome phone calls. You haven't seen the documentary yet, I know. I saw it yesterday, but you'll see it to prepare for the show. But it will be on tomorrow night, PBS's American Experience 1964 is the name of the documentary. And it is remarkable, all that happened during that year. We have yet to talk about Barry Goldwater. We'll do that. Cassius Clay becoming Muhammad Ali. The Beatles. We have yet to talk about the Beatles who arrived on the music scene. So we welcome your phone calls. You may have questions about that year if you were not alive then. If you lived through that year, you didn't forget it. 800-486-8655 is our number. 1964, the year that changed American politics and generations split apart. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. All of those methods of communication, probably only the phone was available to you back in 1964, are available to you right now in 2014. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Martha Reeves and Dancing in the Streets, a hit in the summertime of 1964. Music, of course, was changing pretty dramatically in 1964. And in the documentary, Stephen Ives and all the people who put this wonderful documentary together look at music, and you can't ignore the huge impact the Beatles had on America. They arrived in 1964, Stephen?
Yes, indeed. John F. Kennedy Airport to thousands and thousands of young girls literally losing their minds.
You have footage of them. They just went crazy, didn't they? Screaming.
It is hard to imagine now exactly what a revolution it was. I mean, when they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, they shattered every television record possible. They were frightening to a lot of conservative Americans who couldn't understand why these mop tops were in their high-heeled shoes and their bell bottoms were causing their daughters and sons to a certain degree to just lose their contact with reality. And it's funny, you don't the idea that growing your hair long would be considered a revolutionary act. So absurd today, but back then it was a real statement, and it. But families had arguments about it.
I remember those pretty well. Yes, they did. Yes,
but I think what's interesting about the Beatles is that they reflect one of these fundamental shifts going on in the culture, where the baby boom generation, the young, very by historical standards, affluent and privileged group of young people begin to step up and make a claim for their own role in society. And in a way, they are fundamentally rising to a new level, and it is reflected first in music.
Mm-hmm.
Many things are.
And then you have this wonderful footage of the Beatles meeting. He was then, only for a little while, Cassius Clay, and being refused to be met by Sonny Liston. It was the heavyweight championship of 1964. Tell us that story.
Well, you know, what's amazing is that back in 1964, the Beatles still needed publicity. So they went down to Miami Beach, where Cassius Clay was training to fight against the heavyweight champ Sonny Liston, and anyone who knew anything about boxing knew that Sonny Liston was simply going to destroy Cassius Clay. He was a 7-1 underdog. And so the Beatles went to see Sonny Liston, and he took one look at these four little guys, and he said, "I ain't posing with them sissies." And so they were shuttled off to Cassius Clay's camp, and they ended up getting sort of pushed up the stairs. Clay hadn't arrived, and they were ultimately suddenly sort of pushed into an empty dressing room with the sports writer Robert Lipsyte. And they sort of locked Clay's handler sort of locked the door, and Clay ended up having an exclusive moment with the four Beatles, who were kind of pissed off that they were being manhandled. And then suddenly the door opens, and here's this spectacular image of magnificence, Cassius Clay, because he was such an incredible-looking guy. And he says, "Come on, Beatles, let's go make some money." And he leads them out into the boxing ring, and one of the great photo ops of the 1960s ensues. And it's just an incredible scene. It's really one of the best scenes, and Robert told me that story, and it's such a wonderful example of a first-person story being able to bring a really profound moment in history to life.
Yeah, and very shortly thereafter when he won, was it the next day, he was at this press conference, and somebody asked him, sensitivity of a reporter, certainly not, "Are you a card-carrying Muslim?"
Right. Well, you know, Clay had been flirting with the Muslim faith for years, and shortly after the fight, he announced that he was, in fact, joining the Muslim faith, and he changed his name to Muhammad Ali. But what's so interesting about that press conference is that he's sort of provocative and being challenged by this reporter, and Ali says, "I don't have to be what you want me to be. Mm. I'm free to be who I want." And that is a mantra,
yes,
a kind of clarion call for the entire decade that's about to come. It's the same thing the kids who wouldn't get their hair cut were saying. It's the same thing women were saying after reading Betty Friedan's book. It's this moment of revolutionary change across every aspect of American life. And not surprisingly, Ali was right at the center of it in a way that he would be for the rest of the decade and beyond.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll get to Barry Goldwater in a moment, I promise, but I want our audience to be able to participate. We're talking about 1964 this hour of our show, and speaking with the director and writer of the documentary, which is on PBS, American Experience, tomorrow night. Check your local listings. It should be at 7 in most places in the Midwest. Stephen Ives is with us, has been doing American Experience shows for PBS for a long time. He's directed and written 8 films, and he's also worked with Ken Burns on the Civil War and baseball. Here's our number to reach us, 800-486-8655. Particularly interested in hearing from those of you who were alive during 1964 and have your own set of memories of what was going on politically and in the music world and the women's world, all of that. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Well, I'd like to evoke the name of a former Wisconsinite, Wayne Lyman Morse, who graduated from the University of Wisconsin and its law school, but who was the most prescient politician, along with Senator Ernest Gruening, because he stood up to the phoniness of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the actual incident in August of 1964. And he became that clear voice for the anti-war movement. The vote in the Senate was 88-2. Future anti-war leaders like Eugene McCarthy and Gaylord Nelson and Proxmire of Wisconsin all voted for that resolution. But we can claim him in Wisconsin here. He left at the age of 24 to go out to Oregon and become dean of the law school out there. But I think he's pivotal to that year and a politician that we tend to forget about today.
Yeah, thank you, Jim, very much. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, those two guys really did see something and stand up for something profound that no one else, especially people like William Fulbright and others, should have understood. I mean, they smelled something fishy in the Tonkin Gulf experience. They were brave enough and principled enough to object to it. And I think it's a critical moment again in 64 because LBJ had basically been keeping in sharp contrast to what he did with civil rights, which was to double down on this strategy of trying to pass the civil rights bill and risk his political future in the American South. With Vietnam, he was desperately trying to keep the war off the front burner. He was trying to keep it off stage, push it off until after the election, running as a peace candidate, and doing a remarkably good job about it, triangulating Barry Goldwater's talk about loose nukes and his sort of more outrageous bellicose pronouncements about foreign policy. And then out of nowhere, Americans are in this hot spot in Vietnam, and it's back on the front pages. And LBJ did something deft and extremely shrewd as a politician. He capitalized on the typical rally around the flag kind of reaction people have whenever American troops are in harm's way, even if the second attack in the Tonkin Gulf was completely unsubstantiated. And it's an absolutely fateful moment. I mean, at that point, Johnson is given the kind of freedom and latitude that he's going to use later in the year 1964 to actually make the commitment to American ground troops going into Vietnam. Mm. And we don't see them splashing ashore at Da Nang until 1965, but Johnson makes the decision to send them in 1964,
yeah,
and there's no going back.
And it's his undoing. Thanks, Jim, for the call. Robin, Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thank you. I was 9 in 1963 when President Kennedy was shot and was profoundly affected, very depressed for many months. My theory on why the Beatles were so popular is we needed something to make us happy, something to get giddy over. Has anyone else ever thought of this?
Well, I think Robin is touching on something that Susan Douglas, this wonderful scholar that we have in our film, talks about. And so did Jan Wenner, the publisher and founder of Rolling Stone, who's in the film. There was just something in the sheer joy and the unbridled youth and sort of explosive energy of the Beatles that was completely different from anything that the radio public had encountered. And to be thrust into a moment after the assassination when Kennedy, who was in so many ways the embodiment of youth, the symbol of a fresh, new, optimistic vision for the country, was struck down, was really hard to calculate. And I think she's exactly right, that the Beatles arriving at that moment were a kind of a tonic for the nation, a kind of a collective form of therapy. And the reaction was, extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in part because it was such a relief, mm-hmm. a release of pent-up anxiety and pent-up sadness over what had been a kind of real wound to the national psyche.
Your documentary, to completely switch direction here, although it's part of the year, so it's not switching direction, but I hadn't thought a lot about the importance of Barry Goldwater to subsequent, to Ronald Reagan, to the conservative movement. Somebody in the film says that he really represented in that whole campaign in 1964 the birth of the modern conservative movement. It's a pretty big thing to say.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that that's true. I mean, we forget that Republicans before 1964 were people like Nelson Rockefeller and Henry Cabot Lodge, you know, what people like Phyllis Schlafly derisively called, you know, Me Too Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
They were from the Republican establishment. And if you were what you thought of as a true conservative, if you believed in the kind of things that Barry Goldwater did, a radically smaller federal government, the idea that Social Security should be voluntary, very staunch anti-communism, then these people didn't speak for you. And he became kind of an insurgent, Western, principled standard bearer for millions and millions of Americans who felt disaffected and cut off from the political mainstream and were fed up with it. And I kind of love Barry Goldwater because he's the anti-candidate. I mean, he couldn't go more than a week without committing some horrendous gaffe. He would drone on endlessly. He'd come into a room with an auditorium with like he was the next Messiah, and then he would somehow bring his audience down with a dry speech about tax policy.
Right.
Or something. He simply wouldn't play the politician's game, but. That, I think, was a symbol of the man's unbelievable authenticity and his integrity. He simply was who he was, and his beliefs were somewhat outside the mainstream, which is why, you know, his defeat, which was an overwhelming landslide, Johnson wins 60% of the vote. But what people forget is that Barry Goldwater, who wasn't a very good candidate, won 40% of the vote. 27 million people voted for him. And I think that's a sign, as the conservatives who we interview in our film, Richard Viguerie and Lee Edwards and Phyllis Schlafly, all felt, rather than feeling like conservatism was dead, that they had been vanquished, they felt like they'd been vindicated. Hmm. That this was a sign that although they had lost, that their message had real power. And 16 years later... Ronald Reagan proved them right.
Right. And tell me a little bit more. I believe Hillary Clinton was a member of the Young Americans for Freedom. What was the attraction? What did young people see in Barry Goldwater that made them want to sign up and work for his campaign?
Well, I think a lot of it was what I just said in the sense of he was a kind of an outsider. Oh. He positioned himself that way. I mean, he was a two-term senator. He was close to Jack Kennedy. He wasn't exactly, person on the fringe, but he simply wouldn't go along with the consensus that was going on in Washington. He was attacking Washington at a time when that was a fresh, new thing to do. And I think his frank. Frankness about a lot of these things was profoundly refreshing to people. The problem with Goldwater was he didn't really know how to take, his more extreme positions and play it safe.
I mean,
he could go on. Mm-hmm. At one point, he said he could see he wanted to be able to lob a nuclear weapon into the men's room of the Kremlin. he was the kind of guy who would talk about defoliating the jungles of Vietnam by using low-yield nuclear weapons. This is at a time when Dr. Strangelove, the movie, is playing in movie theaters and where the Cuban Missile Crisis is only a few years old. So he really frightened a lot of people. People really began to believe that he was dangerous. And, of course, Johnson exploited this. There was a bumper sticker that said, "You know in your heart he's right about Goldwater," and Johnson turned around and said, "You know in your guts he's nuts."
Right,
they were really good at exploiting the weaknesses in Goldwater that came, again, out of his refusal to simply play the game.
Right. Mike in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. My comment, 1964 was a big year for me. Because I was married in January of that year, just had my 50th anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And what it brought to mind was I had just returned from Army active duty, and the guy in the next bunk in my bunkhouse was a black man from Nashville. I lived in Milwaukee at the time. And he said to me, "Do you have racial problems in Milwaukee?" And I said, "No, we really don't seem to have any problems," which, of course, was not true. And 3 years later, 2.5 years later, my unit was called up to active duty in Milwaukee when they had the riots, about the same time that the riots occurred in Detroit.
Hmm.
So 1964 was a powerful year, and I remember a lot about it.
Where did you serve in the Army?
Well, I was on stateside. I was at Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
I see. And you've been married 50 years. You and your spouse have been through a lot.
Yes, we have. And I clearly remember 1964.
I think it was a busy time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's touching on a central aspect of the year, which was that civil rights was no longer a regional issue. It was becoming a truly national concern. I mean, of course, in 63, it had been all over the news. But there's something about the way in which the Harlem riots really are a sign that this is not something that is going to be confined to the South anymore. And the fact that a group of young people go down to Mississippi kind of makes it an international experience. I mean, the Freedom Riders had, of course, been there before, and there had been these critical moments in the evolution of the Civil Rights Act, but the Civil Rights Movement. But then again, no one had ever done what Johnson did, which is he passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in June of that year. He overrode the longest filibuster in the history of the Senate. He subjected senator after senator to what they called the Johnson treatment, which was just this unbelievable full court press where Johnson could cajole and bribe and threaten and extort your vote out of you. We forget that how extraordinary and revolutionary that Civil Rights Act was. It fundamentally changed the entire social structure of a whole part of the country. It wasn't the end of the story, but it was a profound moment.
Yeah, and you have so many of these great pictures talk about cajoling of Johnson just right in somebody's face. I mean, his posture is he's just leaning right into somebody. How can you say no to this? He was probably somewhat intimidating, right?
Yeah. He literally towered over people, and he was relentless. And that's what I say about the irony of this, which is that, of course, John Kennedy was an extraordinary president and a man who did great things during his 1,000 days. But when you really needed something done in Washington, Lyndon Johnson took it to an entirely different level.
Mm-hmm.
And the great tragedy of Johnson is encapsulated in 64, because the Great Society is this soaring statement of principle and this dream of his that is as ambitious a kind of program as any president has ever asked America to embrace. And yet, really by the end of the year, Vietnam is looming as a shadow over Johnson, and it's astonishing how quickly for him it all spirals into kind of bitter and sad resolution, and it's not a pretty thing.
No. Stephen Ives is our guest this hour. His documentary that he directed and wrote will be on PBS tomorrow night. It is titled 1964. And there was a lot in that year. LBJ and the Great Society, Barry Goldwater, the birth of the modern conservative movement, Freedom Summer, riots in cities in the country over issues of racial equality, the women's movement, the publication of The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, the rise of Malcolm X, the Beatles, the free speech movement on the campus of UC Berkeley, and the list goes on. 800, Mike, thanks for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number. And you can send an email, talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1964, the U.S. Surgeon General announced the health risks of tobacco, kicking off a constantly evolving anti-smoking public health effort. Later today on Central Time, a Wisconsin researcher talks about what worked, what didn't, and where smoking stands today. Let's go to some emails. Jeff on email says that on September 3rd of 1964, LBJ signed the Wilderness Act into law, the first time in human history that wilderness was given legislative standing. Jeff wonders if you might see as the role of freedom, independence, and the power of the individual, as was seen in 1964, might have had in the birth of the environmental movement.
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting moment that Johnson steps out and does that. I wouldn't overplay it. There are, you know, huge steps that are taken earlier, you know, by Stuart Udall and others in the Kennedy administration, and I think that wilderness is, you know, something that is a thread that runs through our culture from Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot at the turn of the century, and John Muir all the way up. I mean, I think that what's interesting is that Johnson was pushing a bunch of very forward-thinking ideas. The idea of a war on poverty seemed utterly impossible, and you know, there was just a study recently saying that you know, it in many ways the war on poverty was never realized, but the poverty rate in America was cut in half during a lot of the decades after Johnson. So it's hard not to see it as being successful on a lot of levels. And so in many ways, the conservation idea was part of this attempt to both marshal the power of consensus, because Johnson was pretty much of a pro-big business guy. He wanted growth, and he wanted tax increases, and he wanted a bigger and bigger budget. It was the first time when a president could actually say, I want to do all of these programs and pay for it as well. I mean, America was simply in the middle of such an economic boom that all these things were possible. And I think that his move towards conservation and wilderness was just part of that grandiose idea that Johnson had, that anything and everything was possible under the rubric of the Great Society. Mm-hmm. It's dizzying, but it's what he really believed.
And he believed we could do it in a hurry. I remember that State of the Union address. We did a show on that recently, on the war on poverty, that by golly, not only can we do this, we can have this done by this summer, a few months away.
There's a great story we couldn't even put in the film, but he calls up Sergeant Shriver, who's running the Peace Corps, and he says, you know, Sarge, I want you to run my war on poverty. And Shriver says, well, Mr. President, can I talk to my wife about it? And he's basically like, no, I'm you know, I've already announced you at the press conference.
I mean, right.
Johnson did not let anything stand in his way.
Right.
He was a man in a hurry.
Richard in Duluth.
Oh, hi. Yeah, good program you got going here. I remember one significant thing to me from 1964, by the way, as a senior in high school then. That was the last year that there was any silver in American coins. And I think our money has lost a lot of power since then.
I must say that's something I never thought about being associated with 1964. But is that significant, do you think, Stephen?
Well, I think it's an interesting fact. I mean,
right.
It's not something that has jumped out at me before. But I think that, like I said, I mean, what's interesting about 64 is how much money there really was in the culture, in particular for young people. A senior in high school like our caller here would have been part of a generation that in many ways was more affluent, obviously depending on your socioeconomic status, but broadly defined was more affluent and had more opportunities than any in history. It was the coming of age of the baby boom generation. And that, once, as someone says in our film, Susan Douglas says, once you start to matter economically, then it means you start to matter politically. And I think that that's what you see in Berkeley. You see a group of people who, in particular young kids, who had spent, some of them had spent their summer in Mississippi fighting for African-American voting rights. Then they came back, and a group of sallow, pasty-faced college administrators told them they couldn't distribute leaflets for their political causes, and that didn't go over well. And what resulted was the first student movement, And as Jan Wenner, the founder of Rolling Stone, says, student protest, as we now know it, began there. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, I think, I can't remember the exact number, I think it was 800 students were arrested when they occupied Sproul Hall, the administration building. So it really is a kind of high watermark, a benchmark for the kind of student protest that the following year is going to turn against the draft and against the war. And like anything else, it was a critical moment when, in this case, young people chose sides. And they chose a side that was very much at odds with the establishment.
Thanks, Richard, for your call. Jake in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, yeah, I want to thank your producer for getting me the quote. I can't remember it well, but Goldwater said, I believe it was, extremism in defense of freedom is no vice. And unfortunately for those on the right and the conservative movement, I think it should be extremism in defense of extremism is no vice, because what I'm seeing right now is a conservative movement that is basically made up of remnants of the last of the Archie Bunker type of conservatives. Like, the social conservatism is waxing its power and towards the end and just trying to prove its own relevance regardless of having any ethical principles or anything else. I just see a bunch of anger and nothing of value, at least in that social conservative end. And I think that is towards its end with gay rights, legalization of marijuana, and other things in the society. It's just passing them by.
Stephen.
Well, I mean, I think what's so interesting about Goldwater at the convention is he's been dubbed an extremist by Nelson Rockefeller, and he's basically gone through this deeply divisive split in the Republican Party, and he's managed to win the nomination, which no one expected him to do. And so the natural thing to do at that moment is to rally the troops and move to the center and build bridges and get ready to run against the Democrats in November. And instead, Goldwater walks out and says, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. He, in effect, wanted to say, I am a radical. I am extreme when it comes to my principles. That's why people have put me where I am, and I'm not going to compromise about that. And, you know, if you take that phrase, which has become kind of a famous phrase, in isolation, it's not that crazy a thing to say. But at that moment in the campaign, when everyone was basically worried about Barry Goldwater being a kind of loose hand on the nuclear trigger or a kind of a guy who's on the edge of some of these issues, to embrace a label like extremism was politically incredibly foolhardy. And I think that, you know, Goldwater has stood for an uncompromising brand of conservatism. And I think that if you look at 1964 and the Johnson-Goldwater campaign, I think it's possible really to see the birth of the kind of polarization and red state, blue state America that we now live in. And I think that in that sense, what's interesting about 1964 is that it's the first moment when the world that we live in first became visible.
Well, and the other thing that we have to remember is for him to say that moderation is not a virtue, which was the second part of that statement. Wait a second, moderation is not a virtue? Don't we all believe in some kind of moderation?
I think he said moderation in the defense of justice is not a virtue. So he's trying to kind of set up a kind of powerful phrase that his speechwriters thought would be a home run. Unfortunately, in the nation's press, it didn't play that way.
And right.
It played out that way over the course of the campaign.
Yeah. Well, I hope you go on to 65, 66, 67, 68.
A whole network of the 60s.
Yeah, I think you should. Don't you?
Sure.
All right. We'll look forward to it. And thank you so much for being with us. Well, thanks for doing the documentary.
Thank you, Kathleen. I've really enjoyed the conversations, and thanks so much to the viewers for chiming in.
Yeah, we have terrific the listeners. There's no doubt about that. Stephen directed and wrote the documentary, which is on tomorrow night, Stephen Ives, on American Experience, and you can see it sometime between probably 7 and 9 tomorrow night. The year ended, which gives you a sense of starting with Bobby Vinton and ending with, oh, this guy had a voice. Sam Cooke. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks for your calls. Great conversations ahead. But I'm afraid to die. Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know.